There are a number of basic economic concepts that our business analysis can help to bring out. We already discussed the factors of production. And so for your business, we talked about what constituted labor, what constituted capital, and what constituted land. So your basic factors of production. And we discussed with the rent buy calculations a term called the rental cost of capital. That is, if you are buying a piece of equipment, how do you decide how much of the cost of that piece of equipment to allocate to a particular time period? Since the capital equipment, by definition, lasts a long time, it lasts several years, how much do we say it costs per year or per month? And we calculate a rental cost. And in effect, we were doing a lot of that when we were doing the rent buy calculations. Okay, the next topic, next concept, we've also discussed a little bit, but I think people are still having trouble with it, which is not a surprise. It's the topic of opportunity cost. And that is, what is the next best use of a factor of production? What is the next best thing that we could be doing with it? Another way of putting it is, what do you have to give up in order to apply a factor of production to a particular business? For example, and this I think trips up a lot of people, when you're operating out of a business out of your own home, it's not right to say that the office space that you take up is free. There's an opportunity cost to using that office space for a business. One way to think of that opportunity cost is you could use that room for a den or for a spare bedroom. Another way to think of it is that you could be using it to operate a different business. So you have to, just because you're operating out of your own home doesn't mean it's free. There's still an opportunity cost. Similarly, if you do the work yourself versus hiring someone, that's true, you don't have to pay somebody, but you yourself could be doing something else. That is, if you were, let's say, in the lawn mowing business and you decide to mow some of the lawns yourself, well, that's less time you have either for leisure or for working for somebody else at a higher paying job or for managing the business. So any way you look at it, there's an opportunity cost to the time that you spend doing work that you might hire someone else to do. And finally, we mentioned that if you finance a business out of saving instead of instead of borrowing the money, if you pull money out of the bank to finance it, there's still the opportunity cost, that is, the money in the bank could have earned interest. And so in a sense, it's exactly like borrowing. It's just that the cost is opportunity cost versus something that shows up as an explicit interest charge on your borrowing. So this concept of opportunity cost is very important and important to keep in mind in evaluating the decisions that you make about how to operate a business and in ultimately deciding whether the business really is profitable. Because if it takes up too much of your time, if it takes up too much of your saving and so on, then it's the opportunity cost is too high and the business is not really profitable. The next concept is fixed cost versus variable cost. Fixed costs are the costs of setting up a business. So before you can even sell anything, you may need to rent an office, you may need to buy some computers, other equipment, and so on. And those are fixed costs versus the cost of producing more goods and services. So if you're the variable costs are things like the labor time and the supplies that you use up in producing goods and services. Another concept is economies of scale. Didn't come up too much in our businesses because they don't have much opportunities for economies of scale. But economies of scale are situations and economic considerations that allow a larger business to operate more efficiently than a smaller business. So a classic case would be electrical power generation. You build a giant power plant and you can serve a lot of people, but with a small power plant, you may not be able to serve anybody. So that you have to reach a certain size in order to be effective, and that's an extreme example of economies of scale. Another example of economies of scale, something like Walmart's logistics system, their ability to get goods from the right supplier to the right store at the right time. That system operates very well over a large number of stores, and it provides an economy of scale. In fact, Walmart, in some sense, created an economy of scale in retailing where before there wasn't any. Before, the typical drugstore could be a mom-and-pop drugstore, but because of the way Walmart manages its logistics system, it found a way to produce, to bring products into the store at lower cost if they had this gigantic distribution system with many stores. So that's economies of scale. The next concept is unit labor cost. So you take your wages per hour divided by output per hour. So if you have to pay, let's say somebody who's cutting hair, you have to pay them $10 an hour and they can do two haircuts, then the cost of a haircut in terms of labor is $5. That's the $10 divided by the two haircuts they can do per hour. So $5 would be the unit labor cost in that case. And unit labor cost is very important to track because first of all, your price has to be above unit labor cost. If your price was below unit labor cost, you're going to lose money. Secondly, you have to compare unit labor cost to other people's unit labor costs because if your unit labor costs are higher and you try to price higher, you're not going to get any business. There was one group that wanted to try to run this catering service business where they would supply waiters and servers and catering and pay workers $25 an hour. And my argument about that is that that's going to make their unit labor costs very high. And people probably aren't going to hire them. People are probably going to be able to find competitors who are paying their workers $10 an hour and have lower unit labor costs and are going to be able to charge lower prices. And that in turn brings up the topic of competition. Competition is a force that provides checks and balances. It means that you cannot allow your unit labor costs to be excessive because competitors will come in and have lower unit labor costs and be able to charge lower prices and drive you out of business. Competition also works at the other end to raise wages. How can that be? You know, people complain that about Walmart, for example, that, well, Walmart doesn't pay its workers enough. But in fact, what Walmart is doing is hiring very unskilled workers who have no opportunities outside of Walmart. And so when Walmart offers jobs, huge lines of people show up to work there because these are unskilled people who don't have better opportunities. And so what an economist would argue is that what workers need is not fewer Walmarts, but more Walmarts. If there were somebody else trying to hire unskilled labor, and who could make effective use of unskilled labor, that would provide competition to Walmart, and so workers wouldn't be lining up to get Walmart jobs. They'd be interested in these other jobs, and other companies would be competing more to drive up wages. So the force of competition is really what provides checks and balances. It keeps companies from setting prices that are too high because competitors will come in and offer lower prices. It also keeps companies from offering wages and benefits that are too low because other companies will come in and take away their labor force. So in the economy, competition is really the force that provides checks and balances. Another concept that we talked about is comparative advantage, and we'll talk about that again. What that means is having the relative ability to produce something more efficiently using different labor. So, for example, a surgeon will not mow her own lawn, even though she may be the best lawnmower in her area, because her comparative advantage is doing surgery. She can be paid much more doing surgery than the value that she gets out of mowing her lawn. Another way of putting it is, even if she could mow her lawn in half an hour, and it would take somebody she hires an hour, it could be that in 5 minutes of surgery, she could earn enough money to pay the worker to mow her lawn. So, comparative advantage is a relative advantage in doing something. And we saw when we discussed in some business ideas that came out in the Washington Post, a lot of these were based on comparative advantage. So you have a wealthy person or high-income person is willing to pay somebody to come and sit in their house and wait for the oven repairman or the cable TV repairman. You have people who are willing to pay somebody to come and groom their pets. That's all based on comparative advantage, that somebody feels that they can earn more at their main line of work, and then they pay somebody else to do something like groom their pet or wait for the cable guy. Okay, so that's comparative advantage. And again, we're going to come back to that because when comparative advantage shows up in international trade, for some reason people have a harder time seeing it when they look at it domestically. Another topic is substitution. That is the ability to substitute different factors of production. So, for example, you may find that rather than use a lot of unskilled labor, a combination of skilled and unskilled labor works best. Or maybe you can substitute capital for labor. And for example, if somebody were to set a high minimum wage, then the reaction of a company like Walmart that has a lot of unskilled labor is not going to be to suddenly raise the wages of all that of our unskilled workers. They're going to try to find ways to substitute using skilled workers and perhaps using capital and to reduce their reliance on unskilled labor. So that would be the phenomenon of substitution. The phenomenon of substitution also occurs in consumption. We had this big run-up in gas prices right after Hurricane Katrina, and people, in fact, cut back on their use of gasoline. I myself noticed on the highways a lot fewer SUVs than I usually see. And I think what that means is that people who have SUVs and other cars were shifting to other cars. They were using their more fuel-efficient cars to get around when gas prices were high. And then again, that's an example of substitution. Related to the concept of substitution is elasticity. Elasticity, in a way, is a measure of how much people will substitute in response to a small price change. And what people have traditionally felt about gasoline is that there's very little elasticity in the demand for gasoline. That is, when the price goes up, people will not respond very much because they have to drive to work. They can't all of a sudden trade in their SUV for a fuel-efficient car and so on. But what we found after Katrina, and frankly I was surprised about it, was the fairly high degree of elasticity, that there was a pretty sharp reduction in gasoline demand, considering what a that people had relatively little time to adjust to it. So this concept of elasticity is very important in a business in terms of deciding how you can price your product. If you're in a very competitive market with lots of competitors out there who are charging a given price, you're going to face what's called a highly elastic demand. That is, if you try to charge a price that's a bit higher than what the market, what other competitors are charging, you'll end up getting no business. On the other hand, if you charge a slightly lower price and can make that lower price well known, then you can capture a lot of the market, and that's called a very elastic demand. And so, in a lot of these small businesses that we're talking about, they are highly competitive. There are a lot of alternatives out there, and so you could expect to see a lot of elasticity. And what that means is when you have a lot of elasticity is that you have relatively little choice as to what price to charge. If you try to charge too high a price, you just won't get any business. And if you try to charge too low a price, chances are, in a competitive situation, your price will be below your unit labor cost if you charge too little, and so you won't be making money. Another concept is arbitrage. Arbitrage is the ability to take advantage of price discrepancies by buying a good in one place or one situation at one price and then immediately turn around and resell it in another place. So, for example, if Macy's were having a sale on something and it was cheaper than at Nordstrom's, but at Nordstrom's would take the returns, you could buy it at Macy's on sale and then return it at Nordstrom's. Now, of course, Nordstrom's won't let you get away with that because they'll ask to see a receipt. But that would be a form of arbitrage if you could get away with it. Or if you saw gasoline selling at one place for a lot less than another, in theory, if you could buy gasoline at the cheap station and sell it at the expensive station, you could earn an arbitrage. Again, people, it turns out they can't do that. In fact, in general, arbitrage opportunities are rare because if they were available, they create easy profits. But the process of arbitrage does is it tends to make prices reasonable relative to other prices, that it tends to reduce price discrepancies. So we talked about rent-buy arbitrage. That tends to make the price of a house appropriate relative to rent, or at least it should. We talked in the gasoline market about cash futures arbitrage. That is, if the futures price of gasoline really goes up, then gas stations have to raise the current price. Otherwise, there would be arbitrage opportunities. And so the cash price and the futures price of gasoline are intimately related by arbitrage. They're tied together by the process of arbitrage. And then finally, just to conclude, I think the main thing that I want you to get out of this business analysis, I mean, this terminology is all useful stuff, and you should try to go over it and see. And if there's terminology you don't understand, just go back and look at it again. But the overall message of this business analysis is that good new recipes are hard to find. It really is hard to start a business. It's hard to come up with a new and profitable recipe, so to speak, in the economy. But when a new recipe is found, when a new business is successful, that is a source of growth. That is, in effect, raising the standard of living in the economy. Anytime a new business succeeds, it raises the standard of living in the economy. But it's very difficult to put all of the considerations together and to come up with a new business that works.